Welcome to The Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This is a special episode of The Archive Project featuring stories from Liars League PDX. I've been involved in literary presenting for almost my entire career, so it's always exciting when a fresh way to present great work emerges. Today, we're going to devote the entire program to Liars League PDX, which is an offshoot of the original Liars League in London. There are also offshoots in Hong Kong and New York. The premise is simple. The organizers pick a theme and invite writers to submit short fiction on that theme. The best of these stories are picked to be read by actors at a live event, hosted this time by Literary Arts in our studio space in downtown Portland. In this edition of Liars League, the theme is East-West. The host of the evening is Pamela Fleischman, who introduces both the writers and the actors. So I'll turn our show over to her. Here's Liars League PDX, recorded live at Literary Arts in September 2016.
Thank you so much for coming to the second event of Liars League PDX. The Far East, Western Europe, America's East Coast, the West Coast, Eastern Oregon, the Willamette Valley, Northeast Portland, Southwest Portland. Each of these brings to mind a distinct idea about lifestyles, political viewpoints, fashion trends, reading habits, pet preferences, means of transportation, any and all elements of how we live, work, play, think, and feel. But can all of that be summed up by a simple directional bearing? And does it create a defining line or a dividing line? Do we automatically fit into such elementary and oppositional stereotypes? Our first story, Infrastructure, is by Liam Lund. Mr. Lund has lived in Portland for over 25 years and is a member of the Shakespeare Liberation Army. He is a playwright, writer, artist, and news junkie. Infrastructure is performed by John Farley.
Infrastructure by Liam Lund. Rena likes high perspectives. She feels home hoisted on her uncle's shoulders. She grips his lightly thinning hair to keep her balance with one hand. The other holds a makeshift sign glued onto cardboard. It drifts over Hank's eyes. Again, he tells her to hold it up. It reads, Keiji Oji-san, in Latin letters. Below that is as close as the four-year-old could manage in kanji under Haha's specific instructions. Haha is Japanese for mom. What does he look like? Rena asks. You've seen pictures of Uncle Keiji, Hank says. He holds her ankles and tries not to let the purple Crocs slide off her feet. I forgot, Rena says. He's Haha's twin brother. He looks like Haha, Hank explains. His brow tightens when he realizes that this might not be true. Hank scans the face of everyone sliding into view from the terminal above. He doesn't know what he's looking for. He's never met the man. Squeak, 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 squeak. A man pulling a wheeled suitcase stops in front of them, having found a way down without using the moving stairs. He looks skeptically at the strange human totem bearing his name, a tall white man with an impressive, overly kept beard that hides all traces of his neck under a half-Japanese child wearing a backpack decorated with princesses. She refuses to go anywhere without it. Good afternoon, he says. Keiji, Hank asks. Keiji answers with a nod and a half smile. They shake hands. I'm Hank, Maggie's brother. Keiji is 32 years old. He wears his vacation clothes, professional but casual. They look new because Keiji never vacations. He has a neatly trimmed mustache, grown to make him look older to his coworkers. His hair is recently cut. It is longer in the front to make his forehead less prominent, a tip from a former girlfriend that planted several seeds of self-consciousness. I'm sorry, my flight was delayed, Keiji says. His English is good, but slow from lack of practice. He often pauses to find the right word. Where is Satomi? She was called back to the pharmacy, Hank says. He reaches up and lifts Rena from his shoulders. She's going to meet us at the party. Mags is still setting up, so she asked if I could come get you. He gently pushes the girl toward her other uncle. Rena is struck by sudden shyness. This little monster wasn't going to let me go alone. Remember what Ha-Ha taught you to say? Rena makes lots of tiny little turns to the left and right before blurting out, Konnichiwa Keiji-Oji-sama. Keiji kneels down to look at his niece. Konnichiwa, Rena-chan, he says. But I think you need to say, Oji-sama. Oji-sama means grandfather. Rena looks confused and disappointed. I'm not old enough to be grandfather. Zip! Keiji pulls out a small package from a pocket in his luggage. It is shiny and green and covered with bombastic Japanese lettering. He offers it to Rena. This is candy for you. Rena reluctantly takes the package and eyes it with all the skepticism a four-year-old can muster. What is it? Hank asks. It's nori, Keiji says. Made with, it's from seaweed. What do you say, Rena? Hank asks. Remember? Rena says, arigato. In Japan, you're welcome is considered unhumble. Arigato gozaimasu, Keiji replies. The equivalent of no, thank you. Bing, 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 bing. Hank's car chimes annoyance at its owner for leaving the door open while he makes sure Rena is properly secured in her seat. Keiji waits outside for Hank to tell him where to put his bag. They drive away from the Portland airport. Hank awkwardly asks questions. He tries to get Rena involved. She continues playing shy. Keiji is a quiet man. He doesn't like Hank. He finds his beard ridiculous, his clothing too relaxed, and his sleeve tattoos distracting. Hank is younger, 29, but he carries himself with the kind of personal confidence that is found in Keiji's experience in old men or drunks. Hank fills silences with questions and small talk. The trip into the parking garage gave them time to cover all the cliches, the time difference, the flight, the connections, the little frustrations that everyone endures in order to arrive at the other side of the world. Keiji watches out the window. He travels often for work, conferences mostly. He works for the city of Yokohama, investigating infrastructure and developing maintenance plans. When Hank comments that it sounds stressful, Keiji says nothing. He has his eyes on the buildings and the streets and the people and the overpasses and the bridges, none of them his responsibility because he's not in Yokohama. One building catches his eye as they are stopped at a light. Is that a brewery? Keiji asks. Hank looks over his shoulder at the building. Yeah, are you a beer fan? My hobby, Keiji says. You're in the right town, Hank says. I can recommend a few places. I have a list, Keiji says. He takes a small moleskin notebook from his pants pocket and flips to a page kept by a ribbon. Hank looks down the list, nodding at some items and squinting at others. Not bad, he says. There's like 16 on that list. How long are you in town? Keiji says, Monday. Hank counts the days forward in his head. That's a lot to fit into just a few days, he says, especially after I add a few to the list. Click. A pen appears in Keiji's hand. Oh, yes, he asks. Oh, yeah, Hank says. Rena's high voice breaks in from the back seat. I don't like it! Hank looks into his rearview mirror and finds the candy package open. She has a half-eaten green wafer in her hand and a horrified, disgusted look on her face. A barely chewed part of the candy is in her mouth. Honk, honk. Hank double presses the horn before the car is even stopped. Keiji is surprised to find them on a non-residential street. They are alongside a warehouse. Maggie emerges from the building. She has wavy brown hair to her shoulders and is wearing a formal blue dress. Keiji steps out of the car and is swept up into a powerful hug. Maggie is famous for her hugs. When he first met her in Japan 3 years ago, he was shocked to be pulled into a stranger's embrace. He didn't know if he liked Maggie, but she made Satomi happy, and that was enough to convince him that he did. She welcomes KG, and they have a brief and obligatory exchange about the flight. Maggie snaps at her brother, "What took you? Some people have already arrived." She pulls Rena out of the car and kisses the top of her head. "It's not my fault," Hank complains from the driver's seat. "I'll be back as soon as I can." The door is shut, and Hank drives away. KG mentions that his luggage is still in the trunk, but Maggie comforts him with the knowledge that Hank will return to the party. He follows Maggie and Rena up a flight of stairs and down a short hallway. Rena whispers, "Mom, I don't like seaweed." They enter a large room with a high ceiling. It's set up for a party. A band is performing a sound check. KG spots his sister talking to a couple. Her hair is different than he's seen it before, but he would recognize his twin from across a much larger room. She excuses herself and rushes across the room to embrace her brother. Maggie takes Rena and leaves them to catch up. They converse in Japanese for a few minutes. Most of their correspondence on the last several years has been through email, but they soon find themselves in a familiar rhythm. Keiji would never admit it to himself, but the first years after Satomi left Japan were hard. She was abroad, finding herself, while he was home, rebuilding himself. Maggie returns. Keiji is finally able to say happy anniversary to them together. He promises he has a gift for them in the trunk of Hank's car. Another couple approaches. They say happy anniversary. Maggie and Satomi echo the words. More people arrive. The ritual continues. Each couple is greeted with happy anniversary. Hank returns with a pair of beer kegs and taps them. The first person he brings a solo cup is Keiji, who tries it and gives his approval. They talk about beer for a while as more guests arrive. Satomi brings everyone to her brother to introduce. The names float into his head and then right back out, despite his honest effort to remember. He has another beer. The band starts to play. After a while, and another beer, KG approaches Hank with a question. He shouts into his ear against the music. "They congratulate Satomi her anniversary, but she does the same," he says. "Is this custom?" "It's all their anniversary," Hank says. KG's confused. He thinks he's translating it incorrectly. "You mean Satomi and Maggie?" he asks. "It is their anniversary." Hank suddenly realizes that he has to think about what he says. The language barrier is one thing, but this is genuine misunderstanding. "It is," Hank says, but it's theirs too. May 19th, the day they overturned the Oregon law that said that they couldn't marry. These are all the people who came to the courthouse that day and demanded they be issued licenses. "I'm sorry, KG, I thought you knew that." KG looks out at the crowd of people. They fill the room. They are dancing and eating and drinking and talking and laughing. They brought their children. They brought their parents. They brought their friends. He takes a sip of beer. It is cold and hoppy and bitter and delicious. He finishes his cup and sets it on the table, then walks away, leaving Hank the empty. KG finds his sister and Maggie. "Why am I here?" he demands. "This is not your anniversary." "It's one of them," Satomi says. "You know what I mean," he says in Japanese. "You said it was important that I come. Why am I here?" "I needed to see you," Satomi says, in English to keep her wife in the conversation. "I need to talk to you." "I am here," KG says. "You're drunk," Satomi says. "Tell me," KG insists. Satomi sighs and says, "We want to have another baby." KG shakes his head and asks, "What? What is that to me?" "I carried Rena," Satomi says. "Maggie will carry the next." "We know that this is a strange thing to ask," Maggie says, "and you have every right to say no." "What are you talking about?" KG asks. Satomi steps forward and puts her hand on her brother's shoulders. "Our first choice would be to have the donor be family," Satomi says in Japanese. "Rena's father is from Maggie's family." A realization falls over KG. He looks out across the hall and finds Hank toasting a few people. Droplets of beer drip down his beard. "He is Rena's donor," Satomi says. I didn't want to bring it up like this. I wanted us to spend a few days. I want you to know our family. Keiji brushes her hands off of him. I would not. Satomi closes her eyes and says, I know. Keiji follows Hank to the car and waits for his brother-in-law to open the trunk. Let me give you a ride to the hotel, Hank says. I can get a taxi, Keiji says. I insist, Hank says. Where are you staying? Keiji reluctantly gets in the car. He isn't taken to a hotel. Instead, the car stops outside a building with big windows and dim lights inside, a brew pub. It is already closed for the evening. Let me show you something, Hank says, taking the keys out of the ignition. This place has great beer, but an even better bartender. Keiji is angry with the tall, bearded man. He knows Hank has found a window into his curiosity. Tap, 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 tap. The bartender, a woman with short brown hair and a tank top, was cleaning and talking to one of the cooks as he finished his nightly beer. She comes to the door, turns the lock, and opens it. Hey, babe, she says. She kisses Hank. Did I miss the party? I was just finishing up. We left early, Hank says. This is Keiji, Satomi's brother. This is my fiancé, Corey. She beckons the men toward the bar and reaches for two little stemmed goblets. She pours each of them to the top, full of pitch black. The promise of a new beer has convinced Keiji to give Hank a few more minutes. Corey has a tattoo on her shoulder and a ring in her nose, and Keiji would not like her if she wasn't smiling and warm and handing him a glass that smells of licorice and hazelnut. You mind if I show him the brewery? Hank asks. Go ahead, Corey says. You know where the lights are. Hank and Keiji take their glasses and step through a door. Inside is all dark. Clunk, 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 click, hum. A flicker turns into a steady light, revealing several great towers of sweating stainless steel. Hank stands by a switch against a steel support. Keiji walks, taking stock of the equipment, the hoses, and the many barrels stacked against the walls, the bubbling of fermentation, the smell. Keiji takes a sip of the black. Does she know? He asks. About Rena? Of course. She comes with the package. How does she feel? It was a little weird after I told her, but Corey adores Rena, Hank says. She understands. I don't understand. Well, they can't have a kid together, and you're the closest to Satomi genetically. That I understand, Keiji says. How you could let another raise your child. Hank savors a long sip. I don't think of it that way. I helped my sister create her family. With your daughter. Even if they did the sperm bank thing, I'd still love that kid, Hank says. Satomi wanted her child to come from a part of Maggie, and Maggie wants her baby to be part of Satomi. You are part of Satomi. I don't know if I can, Keiji says, looking into the spiral of foam at the top of his beer. You don't have to, Hank says. You shouldn't if you aren't sure. I wasn't for a while. Keiji asks, what convinced you? Satomi, Hank says. How much she loves my sister. He adds, and a lot of beer. For me, it would take too much quantity of beer, Keiji says. Well, you have a list. What time do you want to start tomorrow? Hank holds up his glass to toast. Keiji looks at it and then back at his. Clink.
An American woman is lost in translation and tries to explain herself in this next piece written by M.E. Bergstrom. Ms. Bergstrom spent almost 8 years in China. While there, she wrote a number of articles and one book. Number 58 is performed by Barbara Kite.
Number 58 by M.E. Bergstrom. Oh, thanks again for meeting me early. Pull up a chair. I already got you a drink. Sip slowly. The bartender isn't shy here. Oh, of course, you're welcome. Sorry. I'm not letting you talk. I've always been like this. I blabber when I get nervous. Yak, 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 yak. Just go with it. Something happened. I know you're not a prude. You've been in China for a long time, and I don't have to tell you what was special about the massage parlor Allison recommended. I went there tonight. I was just there. Oh, let's both take a drink. At least you're not as judgy as my friends back home. We live in different worlds, and Chicago is nowhere near China. Not that I don't love them, but really, they are prissy gossips, every one. I shouldn't say that. Oh, they're all lovely and interesting in their own way. It's not their fault that they're afflicted by small-mindedness. For them, flirting with the barista is daring, and buying a Tesla is cutting edge. Who they are and what they buy is already established. Sex and commerce don't meet. And in Chicago, nice married women with kids have sex with their husbands or go bone dry. I don't know how they do it. How do they resolve being hot and powerful one day and invisible the next? Maybe they get that from their work, you know? Maybe if I had stuck it out with art history, Dürer was hot and I look great behind a desk. Who knows? How can I have a career when we move all the time? Every 2 years, I just get packed up and shipped with a new nanny and a new driver like a complacent pet. I'm really not judging. Had we stayed in the U.S., I bet I would be just like my old girlfriends. I would make innuendos over macchiatos, have a kick-ass wardrobe, quietly resent my husband and kids and call it a day. But I'm not there, I'm here. As Allison likes to say, in China we have options. Here, local men all use prostitutes. Or have girlfriends that act like prostitutes. You trade money for affection and power unapologetically. And it's not just a club for men, women get in on the action too. Look at Allison. She pays for it, and she's gorgeous, successful, and single. But she can't get a second look in this country. Asian guys don't have the balls to approach her, and Westerners, ruined, pot-bellied white guys start acting like they're the second coming of sexy Christ within a month here. Oh, come on. I have a husband who looks like a number two pencil, but somehow still doesn't pay any attention to me. Let's ignore the fact that there are some women are lined up around the block to go out with him here, Mr. Paycheck Xianxiong. And let's just quickly acknowledge that these women are thin and giggly and look 12 years old like supermodels. You know, it makes him feel like George fucking Clooney. Stop. Stop laughing. You try living with George Clooney for 5 minutes, especially China Clooney. 5'8", balding engineer who looks at you like you're in PowerPoint. Anyway, enough bitching. I decided to go to Allison's massage parlor, the one on Wukang, down the lane, with a neon bamboo sign, you know, double happiness. the one she's always winking and nudging about. Her standing appointment on Saturday night, number 58. That's right, that's the one. Let's get another drink. As I walk down the lane, I start to feel sweaty. I wonder what Sean Liu thinks of me. We must all look alike, us foreign ladies, tie ties, being driven to lunch in navy or blue Buicks, taking photography classes. He's been our driver for years, but we've never ventured here specifically. I wonder if Sha Lu knows the reputation of this place. He must, right? If he doesn't know by now, I'm sure he'll find out while he's waiting. Anyway, I'm walking and feeling just a peep of guilt. I've spent weeks debating with myself about this happy ending. Is this desperation or liberation? I think about my gender studies. What would Naomi Wolf think? I'm sweating through my clothes from the nerves and, of course, the 1,000% humidity. I'm flapping my silk blouse away from my new black Notori brow, and I'm wondering, what does it matter? Did I even need to dress up? Who's this for? Wouldn't I get the same results if I had skipped the perfume and stuck with the yoga pants? I pass a group of old ladies and kids. I have no idea what they're saying, but I know it's about me. I understand. Lao Wai, of course, foreigner. The restaurant, midway, down the lane, smells like that god-awful, stinky tofu. And obviously, there goes my Chanel. I get to the massage parlor. They lead me in. There are stones and waterfalls, and honestly, the place is beautiful, very chic, very zen, almost like Japan. Any other time, this would seem like the perfect retreat, but I'm nervous. All I can see and feel is every cell in my body panicking. I have to talk myself down. Get over yourself, I think. I'm going to do it. I'm already resolved. I'm here. This is happening. I call on the spirit of Professor Pat from Feminist Theory. Drop your bag and take the tea, for Christ's sake. Enjoy it. You're going to feel like a person again. You're going to take back your power. I've booked the special oil massage. It's the most expensive, so I'm confident it's the right one. I'm relieved when the receptionists at the front seem to know what I'm talking about. It's not on the menu, how apropos. They smile widely when they call down number 58 on the walkie-talkie, so I'm sure the guy has a name. But you know, massage places never use anyone's names. It's all Chinese names. Fair enough, all those Y's and X's and no R's. Or maybe these places have a high turnover with everyone coming and going back to their hometowns. What do I know? I'm going to do it, right? But I'm thinking, and I'm laughing. What am I going to do? Yell out, oh, yes, number 58 in the throes of passion? I'm not complaining. I went out with a guy for a month in college, and he only called me baby. What's the difference? He comes down, and I swear to God, there are sparkles in the air. Just like Allison said, he's built like a giant. He's a foot taller than the other masseuses. And the Mandarin collar pajamas that everyone is wearing barely fit him. He's the kind of guy people would assume plays basketball. My feet keep falling out of the bamboo slippers as I follow him up the steps and towards the rooms in the back. It's so dark and there is no sound, just the Japanese fairy music they pump into the hallway. I'm disoriented, for sure, but revved up because I know what's coming and next. And he takes me to the room, and he shows me where to put my clothes. He steps outside, but leaves the door ajar. Maybe he's watching me, right? Maybe he's checking out the goods. So everything comes off, and I'm going slowly because I think I have an audience. I want him to want me. I even fold my underwear. That's classy, right? I'm naked, lying face down on the massage table, and pretty pleased with myself. I don't feel desperate like I thought I might. I feel dynamic. I don't need to wait for someone else to give me my power. Good for me, right? And thank you, Allison. He enters the room, and although I can't see, I can feel the presence. It's like the air is warmer. There is no sound, but the sound between us. There is nothing between us but the thin sheen covering my body. He asks if I have any problem areas, if I hurt anywhere. I say, I'm here just to relax. And I tell him I'm a friend of Allison's. Oh, Allison, he says, and I'm sure that he knows what to do. I can relax. There are no more words necessary. Good thing, too, because, you know, his English is bad, and my Chinese was, after 2 months of being... Okay, you're right, back to the story. Between the Nivea I put on before I came, and the oil, and the humidity, to be honest, I'm not sure how he could get a grip. Anyway, he touches my legs, I'm getting hot and bothered, touches my back, touches my butt. His hands are everywhere, left, right, and nearing center, if you know what I mean. The lighting is low and the candle is flickering from the AC. I am all anticipation and ready. He tells me to flip over. And I'm thinking, this is the big moment. This is it. I'm wondering if I should look him in the eyes or just let him get to work. As I flip over, I feel something extra under my hip, like a little bundle. I pull it out and I try to hold it up to the light to see what it is. The strangest thing, it looks like a white baggie with hair bands. I stretch it out and can make out three holes. I feel sick. I mean, my stomach drops because down to the floor, it's a pair of disposable underwear. Oh God, I'm thinking to myself, am I not supposed to be naked? Bartender, another round, please. Less ice. Let's make it through the rest in one piece. Just as my brain is wrestling with the idea that those underwear were intended for me, I hear him. He's working on my upper thighs, and then suddenly he clears his throat. His English has improved rapidly, and he's talking in full sentences, but he's not saying what he's supposed to say. He's telling me how lucky I am. How lucky I am. He's talking about my kids and telling me how lucky I am. This man has the gall to assume that I have kids. I mean, I do, but to be called a mother, especially when you're naked, it's just so degrading. He's not looking at me like a patron. He's looking me at me like a matron. He's joking about my children, asking about them, how many I have, how old they are. And of all things, I'm responding because I'm in shock and, come on, I don't want to be rude. He's telling me I look good for my age. Not good for my age, but good for my age. He's talking to me like a mom, not a MILF. He's telling me I need to wear higher-waisted pants to protect my lower back. I need to eat less salt. Every word is like a knife popping holes in my ego. I'm deflating. All of the power I had just a few minutes earlier is leaking out of the room, riding without a seatbelt, because who gives a f***, and is going to crawl under the covers and watch Bridget Jones. Now, there's a difference between nerves and anxious. Nerves means something good could happen. Anxiety means something bad is going to happen. Naked and feeling like an idiot, I'm anxious. The tingling in my body, the innocent nerves are all hard edges like a neon arrow telling me to get out now. I don't even pretend to look at the clock when I tell him that I'm running late. I just say that I have an appointment I forgot about. He looks confused. I'm sure he thinks I'm senile. He can think I'm a pervy gram. I couldn't care less at this point. I'm aiming for safety of meeting you here and hiding my shame in a stiff Cosmo. Yes, that's when I sent you the message. So when I'm all dressed, he's waiting for me outside. He's checking his phone, and he obviously has better places to be. He smiles at me. Is it mocking? I'm not sure. I feel like I'm in the Matrix. Nothing is what it seems. I'm flustered, more than a little embarrassed and angry. And wouldn't you know it, my opportunity to turn things around walks right in the door. Bam! It's a couple of moms that I know from my kids' school. I don't know them well, but just their first names. I've seen them around at fundraisers and Chinese New Year socials at the American Chamber. They're from Virginia. Or Vermont, maybe. I'm not sure. Like me, they've been around the block. I'm sure they've heard about this place. We exchange air kisses. They're definitely not from the West Coast. There was no hugging. I tell them all about how great number 58 was and make sure to point him out, the guy with the big hands. I tell them they get it. Of course they get it. No one's naive. We all laugh like sexy rebels. The heavier one, God, what is her name? Oh, she agrees to take a shot and requests number 58. I trade those ridiculous slippers in for boots, walk past the wishing well at the gate and past the old ladies now carrying their dogs up for a walk. The dogs, for God's sake, why are they wearing overalls? I tell Shalu, Kai Den, which I'm sure he doesn't understand, but somehow he gets me here in record time, just in time to order drinks before you showed up. Now, how's that for a story?
A salesman presented with temptations on the road tries to find balance between two coasts. This next story is written by Mark Jensen, who claims proof of life by his numerous written pieces printed in local and national periodicals and anthologies. The Sales Regional is performed by James Dixon.
The Sales Regional, Walport 1. It was a good morning without rain, and the ragged tails of clouds drifted in towards the All-Sea Bay Bridge like the recollection of a celestial broom. It was a good morning as I walked the slate-gray sand that dipped into the calm salt of the All-Sea River as it flowed backwards past the silent town. It was a good morning as you could see across the mouth of the river just past the spit of sand and into the jumble of white tops tossed like pickup sticks with subdued and wrinkled blue tablecloth that joined the Pacific and the sky in a haze of undetermined distance. It was a good morning as the scent of bacon and morning breath and diesel and unfamiliar blankets slowly became a memory. And it was a good morning to stand blinking at the edge of the horizon, the beach of the sky, dew crying into a folded handkerchief of Queen Anne's lace, and me, with the air cold and damp, filling my lungs with the stink and wonder of the ocean. And this was the final sales trip, east to West Baltimore, a two-story rental cottage in Waldport with the family. A trip through ABC, always be closing. Senior apartments, $100 deposit. This puts you on the list, and you will get the first choice of apartments when we open the doors. Throw your vacuum away, no more dirty dishes, and transportation whenever you need it. ABC, ABC, ABC. all the other things. The question marks like halos around the relationship, my soul-sucking personality, the past that sits like a rock in my shoe, the decisions that are sometimes made without making. Baltimore, Maryland. It starts in Baltimore. Baltimore is the kind of town where women look like ovens below complicated hairdos. Everything about the Atlantic is tired here. The exhausted waves limp into the shore. The barrier islands prepare to disappear. Even the anonymous plastic floating in the bay yawns at the shoreside Hooters franchise as it bumps against the tilted sleeping pylon. That is where we start. In that mausoleum of a city, searching for a woman who does not look like an oven. Someone like Wendy, hovering like smoke near Hooters' entrance. I like to open with a question. It engages the prospect. That open exchange establishes rapport. My speaking voice and style create trust. My demeanor establishes authority. Later, an oven-shaped waitress in hot pants takes away a finished order of chicken wings, the jumbled bones and a pattern of satisfaction and doom. With Wendy here across from me, I lose interest in the oven's open broiler and unusually large exposed elements. The old day was dying the way it does on the East Coast, largely anonymously. It died like that person we always thought was from the neighborhood but turned out to be the Boston Strangler. It would have been harder to chase Lee Part, but instead ended up drunk and naked next to a cockroach in the center of a group of row houses with eyes forward and back, ugly music vibrating one wall. I'd like to imagine I'd wonder that my wife would think, but I know. Miami, Florida. You don't even look at me when I wander through this crowded house alone. Even when I'm home from Miami. The bags jumbled at the door, can't you see? With eyes straight forward at your phone, you don't even look at me. In bed, we agree to disagree, then roll over with an exasperated groan. Even when I'm home from Miami. In Fort Lauderdale, there's Finita, a bikini, a motel, the sea. I wake sweating, thinking you had known. You don't even look at me. In the morning, ringed by kids, it's time to flee. Why you make me feel like a chair or a lamp you own, even when I'm home from Miami. At least when I'm flying, I pretend to be free, as opposed to when I'm chained to a stone when you don't even look at me, even when I'm home from Miami. Dallas, Texas. Big trucks, big hair, big highways, going in every direction to other places in a vast wasteland no one wants to visit. Things were swinging at the airport embassy suites, Ritz and Ranch, celery and sales training, standing with Sophia at the complimentary bar. When I arrived at my question, I must be patient, I let several seconds sit like a pregnant woman waiting for a bus. That and a crafted introduction should generate interest. If it does, Sophia will want to spend some time with me. If not, a little rework and Isabella will be ordering a complimentary beverage soon. Another old-fashioned, make that too. Sometimes I feel like a black hole in the shape of a man. A black hole sucking in everything around me, breaking off chunks and disappearing into me. Nothing escapes. The smile gets sucked in, the eyes, the sparkle gets sucked in, the foyer, the tiny tables get sucked in, the complimentary bar gets sucked in. The eyes, the hands, the smile, the glass elevators viewed from outside, the smile, the hand, the old-fashioned, the smile, the talk, the shoulder gets sucked in, the eyes, the talk, the old-fashioned, the smile, the compliment, the talk, the old-fashioned, the eyes, the sparkle, the suggestion, the foyer, the elevator, the mouth, the room key, the door, the room, the talk. The mouth, the bathroom, the button, the room, the eyes, the mouth, the button, the blouse, the shirt, the button, hook, shoe, sock, zipper, cotton floor, the comforter, the mouth, the eyes, the sweat, the comforter, the pillow, 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 pillow. After everything has been sucked in, it's still not full. Logan, Utah. On the phone, you are so distant, so far away. So distant, so far away, your voice is shrinking. Just another sleepy town in Utah. All the men are the same, like oil tractors out of the barn, around the property, back in at the end of the day. Baseball caps and LDS. About as exciting as Cheese Whiz. A salesman from out of town is the only new item on the menu. On the phone, slipping, I feel you slipping away in clouds of anger. I look into the naked eyes of these women and wonder what they see. Do they see me or some kind of means to an end? And does it matter what they see at all? In them, for a moment, I see honesty, a glimpse of what it is to be vulnerable and human, the two things I can never be. The phone prisoner embraces you so softly, clouds of illusion. But you are the one who knows me, the one who cares for me, who I cannot look in the face anymore. You look through me even now, so far away, and know I am a secret in love with a riddle. The phone prisoner pretends the other end cares, then softly hangs up. Waldport 3. It is good to be here in Waldport. Yakina John Point, another knuckle on the Oregon coast. I leave my shoes and socks on the cool sand, begin to sweep into the biting water. If you face objection, then you're on the right path. We don't have the budget. I don't have the authority. I'm happy with my current state. I'm too busy right now. I need to think about it. It is good to be here in Waldport. The Pacific is playful here, slips across my feet and pushes sand up over them. Soon they are covered. I can feel them moving deeper into the slate gray. As a sales professional, it is important to know how to deal with the common objections. Product knowledge is key. Ask the buyer open-ended questions. We'll probe deeper into the real core of reluctance. The art of sales is deftly handling these obstacles and showing the product in a way that makes it irresistible to the customer. It is good to be here in Waldport. Feet up to my ankles in sand, the tide. Who knows if it's going in or out? Maybe I just didn't love the product enough. Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Strophe. On the phone, so filled with unwanted pregnant pauses, giving birth to a windstorm, all the words ripped away, all the prepositional clauses lost in click. Antistrophe. Words are wasted in a hotel room, looking over lake fresh and blue. A little closing pressure, then boom! I'm alone again in Coeur d'Alene. I never liked the traditional close. The this is the last one at this price, the Ben Franklin, the summary. No, I tried to come across as less of a salesman, more nuanced. The question close, closing as soon as the conversation begins. The engagement close, communicating how product serves, then a call to action. Would you like to come up to my room? Let's continue our conversation more privately. I think we can work that out. Let's go. Strophe. You are the one with kids, with history. You are the one in the house cleaning, working alone. The wind is driving across the lake blustery and reminds me of your face. Antistrophe. And the divorced chef down in the bar, a kid at home and whiskey face aglow, we dance and talk about your emotional scar. Let's go. Strophe. The mornings are always the worst. It's raining outside, streaks across the windows like regret. When we part, I say she was the first, then close the door and try to reset. Antistrophe. On the plane ride home, I break into a cold sweat, look at some sales figures and doze. When I awake, I try to forget, but realized this is what I chose. The plane banks and positions itself to land. Portland is below, seen pinking between the clouds, then the car from long-term parking and the drive to Waldport, where there will be an ending. Waldport 4. It is a good morning. The air so torn and still as the water. The decision to buy, so easy, an emotional decision. I understand that process. What we buy will complete us, will enhance us, will protect us. Above, the seagulls like kites slip in and out of air currents. A bank of fog is held offshore by an invisible hand. The first step into the Pacific is shocking, as is the second, but soon feet are numb. I walk into the confused and hidden sand. Waves toy about my calves and thighs and even higher. Now I am buying. Not quite sure what, but at least I know that it is something. Facing back, a crest breaks over my head, the trough to my waist. The shore a mile away appears and disappears behind the consternation of waves starting, stopping. Beyond that, everything I can close. Real estate, cars, raise market. Ahead, water, whales, sharks, and eventual sunset. Darkness. I choose to move forward.
This next story is written by Cassandra Longus, whose roots began in eastern Oregon and who has traveled to places east and west of that starting point. This story is inspired by her observations of life on a military base. Compass Lines is performed by Megan Catherine.
Compass Lines by Cassandra Longest. I am standing naked in front of the mirror. I think for a moment that I am both too young and too old for such womanly architecture. All military wives wear, in a place deeper than cloth and skin, the weariness of waiting. The waiting is like rushing water against rock, slowly carving lines of both bitterness and gratitude. For the first time in months, I pull out my wedding ring and I slide it back on. It is a simple gold band which fits a little too tightly and gives no quarter to the skin warmed by its weight. The man I have been having an affair with has made no comment when all those months ago the ring so casually disappeared. He could have claimed me on the day I set it aside, but instead he kissed my long girlish hands and held them to his breastbone. I look through my closet, wishing I could wear a piece of him as well. I take a white sundress down and I press my face against the pale fabric. The worn cotton, so easily unraveled at the seams, had been my fragile innocence carelessly discarded. I inhale deeply, searching for my defiance. It does not smell of either one of us, but instead a middle ground of fragrance where we were once united. It is late morning, and the sun is just beginning to appear in the east, where my husband, Aaron, has been deployed. A year has passed where the end of his day was the beginning of mine. "I am sending the light your way," he would say over the phone. The distance at one time was harder. Now the division of opposing compass lines has taken on a wisdom of its own, teaching us how to be whole in our separation. I finish putting on my clothes and walk outside. Texas seems to be always large and bright, even in the morning. Aaron and I were born in mountain country with thickly wooded forests. Here, the sky is wide and heavy, compressing all beneath its reach down into still grasslands. For a moment, I regard the doorways of other military wives who are still waiting. My gaze rests upon 3C, who sits smoking listlessly on her steps, wearing the gray, oversized garments her husband has left behind. She is waiting for news, for phone calls, for scraps of love, and for the day of return. I was once like her, a girl who did not know how to be alone, to possess autonomously my own sense of space and time. Aaron had been gone for 4 months when Peter moved in next door. He was coming home from Iraq, and for years had been only known as Sergeant Foundling. Our first conversation was about something meaningless, on our adjoining porches overlooking the highway to Fort Hood. We both had bought wilting plants, which hung from the roof like little lights, as if to say that the person that was living here was still alive. I didn't see how damaged he was. We are taught not to see it, because maybe it will go away. There was a time when my infidelity was unimaginable. I married my childhood sweetheart at 18, but every other year after our misguided wedding, he left. That is how war is. It is endless, and it stretched us across the map so that we became strangers, tied together by hurried phone calls and hasty emails. My husband loved me on those blissful stretches of peaceful homecoming. However, the version of him, the manufactured reproduction of him that went away to war and that was always gone, had no room for me in his life. Aaron put me on hold because he was a soldier, and soldiers cannot love women except in the dark places inside of themselves, which hope for a future beyond the desert. Peter was not unlike most soldiers, always in uniform with an impossibly straight back and impeccably short hair. His features were blunt, his body well-muscled. He had soft blue eyes, thick lips, and sandy-colored hair that in his childhood must have been like warm butter. By contrast, Aaron was dark and lean, his gaze always sharp and inquiring. They were both handsome, but in different ways. Almost immediately, I learned three things about Peter. He had been deployed 4 times since graduating high school. He had married a lost girl and divorced her in the span of a year. And he had been part of the first wave to enter Afghanistan, which is widely regarded as the most brutal of all waves. Men like him are common. They love, they lose, and then they go back to war under the banner of patriotism and brotherhood. One night while sitting with Peter, I asked, "You have been deployed so many times. Why do you stay in?" We had both been drinking. The phone had broken another promise to me. Peter had been there, so easy to talk to. Our plants almost touching, our camp chairs facing the same direction. He shrugged. It was questions his mother had probably asked him many times. "I have been to the edge of the world and back. I wouldn't know how to be a civilian again. What is there for me to do?" "You could go back to school," I said. "But then I would have to go to the beginning, and I just can't do that," he replied. He couldn't look at me, only at the highway, with its bright candy-colored cars, new and untested, driving by quickly. In my memory, I can still see him sorting out his words, which echo through the folds of my dress. "Sometimes, in this business, you can't start over," he had said. He was trapped. He was a young man, like so many of them who had given up his young man dreams. Peter rose and gazed out over the porch towards the horizon, towards Fort Hood. Taps were being played, and we watched as vehicles pulled over, and men in and out of uniform got out to stand and salute. "They all have that answer," I said, as the music ended and life resumed. "Tell me the real reason." He looked at me with such naked sadness, and I saw for a minute the truth. He had already done things he couldn't live with. Things that hurt him and haunted him in his lonely moments. He wore the fact of his shame and grief so plainly that I was shocked I hadn't seen it before. Suddenly I knew. He had done things, unforgivable things. I found myself wondering if perhaps my husband, my good, sweet Aaron, had ever given someone else that same look. Had he given it to me? Had I passed it by? Shoved it under the bed where imaginary monsters lay in wait. "You wouldn't understand," Peter continued. I was also familiar with this response. The women here are always hearing this answer. How could we possibly understand? We didn't wear the uniform. And if we did, we would know how wrong it is to press the question. After all, how could we admit that the men we love make their living trying to kill the beloveds of other women half a world away? There are things that you don't talk about, so that the soldier can separate their two lives. Not talking about the memories allows our nationally minted heroes to pretend they didn't do those things and that they are not the equivalent of their required actions. We don't ask those questions so that they can come home and aspire to be the person they were before they went away. "You wouldn't understand" is always the end of the conversation. Sitting there, I sensed that Peter wanted me to question him further. We always sense it, but it always seems wrong to pry. "Have you killed anyone?" I already knew the answer. It is the same answer that everyone who has been in long enough eventually has. Peter kissed me then for the first time. Our bodies separated by the porch. It was a sweet kiss. I felt his warm breath on my ear, his calloused hand on my hip. We moved together as if wild pages of profane poetry, our bodies tangling in and out of awareness. He fondled me in the shadows and openly claimed me to the passers-by as temporarily his. Here are the things I remember about my happiness. His legs were sturdy. They held my body on top of his like I was some fragile nothingness that might wash away. His fingers were long and elegant, but they did not touch me with any elegance. Even then, the sorrow slipped in and out. I can still hear our cries from that night, the strands of sounds weaving their way through my life. I can feel my desire for him, my longing for that moment to return, beckoning me back. Why did I fall in love with him? Why did I so readily take off my clothes for this strange man? The answer is intangible. There was a vocation inside of him for me deeper than lust or love. For just a night that turned into many more nights, we succumbed to the need for our own humanity and the reverent wish to not always be suspended by compass lines. Our affair lasted nearly 6 months. And then the rumor came that the 4th Infantry Division, to which Aaron belonged, was coming home. A week after the rumor was confirmed, news spread that Peter's unit was redeploying. One step forward, one step back. We are all caught in the same unmoving dance. Peter didn't want to go, but then of course he did. I watched as he became a stranger again, remembering all he would return to. I knew he was terrified, but also resigned. To be reconciled to the inevitability of deployment lessens the suffering. Peter and I struggled to find the wild rhythm, which had previously been so effortless. When we failed in our lovemaking, I cried, just as I had cried before with Aaron. "You always knew I would leave," Peter said into my hair. "Isn't that why you chose me?" "I can't do it again," I replied. He held me against his heart. His lungs expanded and contracted in our stolen moment, marking the seconds. "Shh," he murmured above me. "I have to go so that your husband can come home." A month later, I said goodbye to him. Now I am driving to Fort Hood, taking the road that is universally known for its blessed homecoming and dreaded goodbyes. Inside the gates, with its high fences and dirt roads, lies a strange city. The lawns are closely cut and have pristine, well-defined edges. Each building has the same coat of white, brown, or tan paint. Men and women in military uniforms walk the streets looking like permutations of one another. I always feel uneasy here. It seems so obvious to me that I am an outsider hiding in their midst. I have always been a secret outsider. I park at one of the gymnasiums. Women and children and old men and women are filtering in. A large "Welcome Home Heroes" sign written in finger paint and decorated with little hearts and flags is hung above the doorway. I sit in the car and stare at the happy children and their grateful, if not beleaguered, mothers who fill the parking lot. Just last week, Peter had become Sergeant Foundling once again, but I had not been there to see it. My presence would not have been proper, but I had helped him pack and sell his furniture. For nearly 10 minutes, I contemplate not going in and leave my husband there to wonder what has become of the life he is always leaving behind. But I do not. I sit in the back row of the bleachers. A Toby Keith album plays on repeat. Women comfort new babies that have never met their fathers, and older children who have never known them. A few veterans approach the podium to speak about the glory of America and sacrifice, but they forget to thank us, those who are waiting for those men and women living half a world away. The bus is pulling up. The rumor runs through the crowd, and without needing to be asked, we stand up as the music changes in anticipation. Aaron is there, somewhere, beyond the building, unloading his bags. Dry ice fills the gym, and the national anthem plays, and then suddenly, there's my husband, tan and bright. Our eyes meet. The distance shortens. Aaron becomes west, just as Peter became east. Who are you, I wonder, of my constant? Excitement fills the crowd. Finally, we collectively exhale. Just 25 feet away, the soldiers stand and salute us. We cheer, and my eyes fill with the man I have loved nearly all my life. A short speech is given, of which no one listens to. From across 35 feet, Aaron has only eyes for me. Soon we are in each other's arms. There is a necessity of joy and hope, and all else is forgotten. In his arms, I can see other men who have no one there to embrace or hold them. I am struck with the guilt of my happiness as I imagine 3C and of the other men who did not get to come home. I imagine Peter, who is now setting foot in Afghanistan for the third time, so that my husband can stand before me. "Thank you," I whisper to him, to both of them, to all of them, who stretch the compass lines.
This next story is written by the London-based writer Liam Hogan. Mr. Hogan is the 2015 winner of the Quantum Shorts Award and SciFest LA's Roswell Award for 2016. His story, The Last Man, is performed tonight by Andre Barnes.
Last Man by Liam Hogan. If it had been a crossroads, I'd have kept on north, kept putting the miles between me and what and where I was running from. But it wasn't. It was a T-junction, the lonely road coming to an abrupt stop, two equally desolate strips of asphalt running at right angles, one east, one west. No road signs, no distances to the nearest town, no street names, nothing. Although barbed wire fence wasn't much of an obstacle, but burnt stubble stretched out to the gray distant horizon. There was nothing for me there. I had to stop burning my bridges. The memory of screamed curses, the heavy thud of heavy men running to her aid, the blood damp against the thin cuff of my leather jacket. Dried now, dried and stiffened, but still there. An accident, of course, a simple misunderstanding gotten out of hand. A slap provoking my explosive reaction. Funny how often accidents can happen to one man. Maybe the witch was right. Maybe I was trouble. Maybe I was going to hell. But I'd kind of like to find my way out of Montana first. So, east or west? If I had a coin, I'd have flipped it. There wasn't anything else to decide on it. The road stretched out the same gray horizon, a hint of distant mountains, the Rockies, perhaps, but not for considerably more miles than I could walk, not without food and water and rest. The only place I knew for sure I'd find any of those things was 2 hours back the way I'd come. I'd get no welcome there, not after what I'd done. I left town at dawn, having spent the remains of the night sulking behind a dumpster, and since then I'd not seen anybody, no cars, no farmers, no one. Mankind may well have been wiped off the face of the earth with me, the undeserved last man. The last of anything, no cattle, no birds, no nothing, bleak and desolate. I'd been wary of cars coming up behind, worried someone might give chase. For any other traffic, I'd been hitching a lift, going any which way, getting the hell out. I slipped off my shoe, shook piece of grit. I tapped my last cigarette from the crumpled pack. Squatting by the dusty scrub of the verge, reluctant to sit, I thumbed the wheel of the plastic lighter, shielding it against the mournful wind, sucking it deeply as it caught. I took time over my smoke. A chance to see if this road was as quiet as the other. And not yet having settled on a direction, I was in no particular hurry. The day was still young. I should have known not to get mixed up with her. My eye was attracted to the exotic types, black hair down to her slim waist, almond eyes of glittering gleam, skin burnished gold. I'd wonder if she was Latino or Native American. Indian turned out to be right, but the other sort, born in the shadows of the Himalayas, an awfully long way from home. The barman had seen me stare. He answered my questions with obvious reluctance. "You don't want to mess with Zia," he warned, his tattooed fingers making the signs of the horns. "She likes heavy metal," I quipped, undoing all the work I'd put in to encourage a generous free pour. But that didn't matter anymore. By then, I'd a new windmill to tilt at. When the Marlboro was burnt down to the filter, I flicked the butt across the road, spinned the empty red pack into the long grass. Rising, I spat into the dirt, the sour taste of whiskey brought back by the hint of nicotine. I stood tall and looked both ways, hoping for the distant glint of a car, or better yet, truck. Nothing, not even a heat mirage to give me false hope. The sun was beginning to crack through the sullen clouds. Maybe it would brighten later. So I headed left, west, which, with the sun to my side and out of my eyes, and till noon at least, hopefully I'd be somewhere else by then. It was an hour's dull trudge before I came to the next T-junction. The same situation, a burnt field of stubble ahead, two roads, left and right, still no signs, still no cars. Without breaking step, I turned right. I didn't want to complete the square, wind up back where I'd started. That wouldn't be good for my health. Another hour, another T-junction, T standing for tedious. I stopped, undid my fly, and let loose a dribble of two yellow piss, which landed on an empty, crumpled Marlboro cigarette pack. I looked back over my shoulder. There wasn't anything to hang my eye on. It all looked the same, but it couldn't be, could it? Slowly, I re-zipped, wandering over to the opposite side of the road, scanned the boundary between asphalt and dirt. The burnt down to the filter nub of a cigarette grimmed back at me. I was getting spooked. It wasn't like cigarette butts or even Marlboro packs were exactly rare. I'd most likely find such trash along with fading cans of Bud on the verge of any road, even one as unfrequented as this, wouldn't I? It was gone noon. The day was warming up. Summer's last hurrah. It wouldn't be long until fall color set in. Anywhere there were trees, rather than the dismal remnants of a harvested crop stretching in all directions. The clouds had been shredded, but not dispersed. Ahead, some loomy gray threatened rain. That could only make a bad day worse. I chewed my lip. Whether this was that first T-junction or not, I was still faced with the same two choices, east or west. This time I went east. An hour later, I was staring down at the damn crumpled pack. The only way I could figure out if the road was one great big circle, so large that it didn't look anything but straight, the same way the earth looks flat unless you're up high, but why would such a road exist? What did it serve? There hadn't been a single turning, not even a dirt track to see some lonely farm, and that was a problem. For the road to end at the same T-junction both ways without there being any other turnings, it'd have to be some crazy Escher drawing, an impossible Mobius strip of bitumen. I'd spent a while scratching figure eights in the dust with the toe of my shoe, but nothing made sense. That second turning, when I'd not stopped, just headed what I thought was north, had been the same junction as the first, as the last two? And if not, then the picture wasn't what I was failing to draw. Dry swallowing, I felt a rough edge to my lips, tasted iron. Whether it was the sun or the wind, I wasn't sure. But this had stopped being fun a while back. How long could I go without water? 12 hours? A day? 2? Still, there was no point in panicking, not yet. The sun didn't move that much in an hour. I'd use my shadow as a landmark, keep it to my right and just behind me, and I couldn't possibly go around in a circle again. I set off, heading west. Too fast at first, and then once the junction had faded out of sight, slackening to a more relaxed pace as the monotony of the view took over. Despite my casual speed, my heart was racing as I approached the next junction, looking for differences and looking for that damn red pack. The sun had stayed at my side, so it was, of course, impossible for it to be there. But still, it was there. I prodded it out into the middle of the road, stamped it flat, and then spun and savagely kicked at it, scruffing my shoe, anger flaring, and then because there wasn't anything else to kick around, fading
When someone slaps you, and it doesn't matter who, you're going to react, to slap back with added interest. And sure, maybe that's not always a wise thing, and it certainly doesn't help you get the girl, but it's not the end of the world, and it's not the worst a man can do. But when she's screaming into my face, calling me all the names under the sun, telling me how she's got people, her 12 followers, who will mess me up so bad even my bitch of a mother wouldn't recognize me, and when she spits the saliva thick with blood, I overreacted. Just as I damn well overreact, but she brought it on herself. You don't spit at a man on a short fuse. Open hands clenched into fists. I still figured she'd come out of it better than I had. She'd recover, and maybe she'd be a bit more polite, more respectful next time. Whereas I'd lost my bag, my wallet, everything I owned in the world, little though that was. I stepped over the barbed wire. The soil was packed dry, the autumn rains yet to descend. I kept going north. Ignore the damn stupid roads. It was late afternoon when I come to the barbed wire fence to a T-junction. I chewed out a hangnail. No sign of the cigarette pack. Not until I remember I kicked it away. Not until the across to the other side to find the flat and misshapen box propped by the corner of the fence post. But that was insane. Impossible. Even though it was currently behind the clouds, the sun had been at my back all the way. I could still feel the warmth on my bare neck. And the clouds parted, and there was my shadow, where the sun should be. I howled into that big sky, felt the expletives rasp against my throat, swallowed painfully, realizing it was doing me no good. Exhaustion was messing with my head. I must have walked in a circle. I must not have been paying damn attention to anything. I'd once stood on a wide, empty beach in the middle of winter. I closed my eyes and attempted to walk straight. And whether it was the wind or the barely perceptible slope, or it was just an impossible task, by the time I counted to 100 steps, opened my eyes and looked back, a long line of footsteps curved away behind me. Same thing here. With nothing to set my sights on, I'd gone in a big arc. One that brought me back exactly where I'd started. I spiked the pack on the barbed wire and set out again, deliberately at an angle, kicking the blackened stalks until the soot covered the scrapes in my shoe leather, stumbling in the tractor ruts. It was just a field. How big can one field be? I saw the red pack hanging by a wire in the gathering gloom ahead as the first spots of heavy rain began to fall, threatening to turn the field into a mire. I turned my face into the gunmetal sky, opening my parched throat for what scant relief it offered. It was dark when I gave up trying to work it out. Dark with my feet blistered, my stomach past empty, my damp frame shivering against the sullen cold. Dark when I escaped purgatory and finally took that third option of tea south. The only option I'd actually ever had. Back the way I'd come. Back to Zia, to a town turned against me to rough justice. Took 2 hours coming out this way. Took much limping my way back. It was near midnight when I saw the glow lighting up the horizon. In the end, the smoke and the flames, the dark forms of a dozen almost men, her followers, spread waiting across the road. Hell, they're not any surprise at all.
You've just heard a special edition of the Archive Project featuring Liars League PDX. To learn more about Liars League and submit a story, go to liarsleaguepdx.com. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe on iTunes. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast with production help from Paige O'Rourke. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without you. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.